Yeah, me too.
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order, March 18th, Friday, 2011. We'll have a public hearing on House Bill 3162. Mr. Taylor, what do we
have? Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3162 comes to the committee on the judiciary. It prohibits a court from changing a child custody, visitation, parenting, or support order if one parent is a deployed parent and that parent is in active military service. It applies until 90 days after the completion of the deployment. Chair, members of the committee, you have a dash two amendments that come from the administrative, the Division of Child Support, which basically requires that they get notice in additional to the courts when the person comes back from active military service.
Okay, is Mr.
Caldwell
here?
Yeah.
There he is. General Caldwell. And Mark Vaughn, is it Van Susie? Fossey?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest, including Oregon. Thank you for taking up this matter. And I had some written testimony passed out. I work for the Undersecretary of Defense Personnel and Readiness, and this is one of our 10 key issues for quality of life for military families. In an environment where the divorce rate among military unfortunately continues to climb, and many of you probably saw our recent report last week of a 50% divorce rate among females in the military, many divorced service members have custody of or visitation rights with children whose other parent is not the service member's current spouse. Many of these service members who are deployed away from their family find that many states do not consider the unique aspects of military service when making custody decisions. These absences due to military service can undermine and disrupt existing arrangements, creating stress on parents and children. Without contact from their children, deployed members are frequently devastated, and it degrades their ability to focus on their mission. Obviously, focusing on the mission is important and paramount. Inequities in some state laws contribute to this stress to the point where, since 2009, this issue has been one of the 10 key issues for the Department of Defense State Liaison Office to focus on in the states. Although the Department of Defense believes the welfare of a child is paramount, it also believes the demands of military service should not abrogate the parents' rights. While the Defense Secretary Gates recently has also supported federal efforts in this matter, we still believe in federalism and wish to work with the states to and feel like the states are in the best position to balance such equities, and believes that several protections states can enact which would serve both the Oregon military parents' rights and the welfare of the children. The policy put forth in the language of HB 3162 addresses all of the areas of concern relating to service members and child custody. You should know that Oregon already does two protections of the five that we seek, and ensuring courts do not consider deployment to be, one is that the courts do not consider deployment to be the sole factor in custody decisions, and the other is that Oregon already allows for delegation of visitation and guardianship when the service member parent is deployed and members of that service member's family want to stay involved with the child in that service member's absence. These are great statutes, and we are thankful you have them in place since 2007. What this bill seeks is further protections in three other areas where the Department of Defense seeks to help the deployed service member. First, in prohibiting the court from setting aside, altering, or modifying custody or parenting time from provisions of annulment, separation, or dissolution judgment involving a deployed parent until 90 days after completion of the deployment. This will allow the service member time to decompress after often harrowing deployed circumstances and enable that returning service member to better manage the circumstances they find themselves in upon return and ultimately to be better parents. Second, authorizing a temporary order modifying the terms of a judgment to reasonably accommodate the circumstances of the deployed parent makes sense and is in the best interest of the child, and providing the pre-existing judgment to be automatically reinstated upon completion of deployment makes sense because that provides the consistency so important in parenting. Third, charging the court to make reasonable accommodations to allow a deployed parent or one whose deployment is imminent to use today's technology to provide video, electronic, or internet testimony in a proceeding when the deployed parent cannot reasonably fly from Afghanistan or other places to personally appear in a court makes sense because the deployed parent should not be penalized for serving our nation by a mandated absence he or she cannot control. In closing, with the substantially increased and continual activity of our armed forces around the world today, many states are rallying and recognizing the need for statutes which protect the rights of both service members and their children. At present, 38 states, including Oregon, have passed laws that address some or all aspects of the difficulties facing parents who temporarily must give up custody of their children or must forego visitation when called to take up the burdens of the nation. Including Oregon, 16 states this session are actively considering more legislation to get those five provisions we seek. I wish to thank this committee for taking up this issue and look forward to leadership in this, and thank you for your support. And please, if you could, move it forward.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. We support this legislation. I think a couple of facts for your ratification. Since 2002, the Oregon National Guard has deployed over 14,000 individuals. Just about a little over 1,000 people in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places in the Middle East. And we're scheduled to deploy another roughly 500 people in the next year. So this is a continuum of what we've seen. The information that Mark brought out about the divorce rate is accurate, and it's fairly consistent in the state of Oregon with our troops. We're seeing a considerable increase in this, and it's disturbing, but there's not much we can do about that other than try to work to make it as reasonable as possible at the end of the day. So it does have its stresses, it does have its inconveniences, and certainly anything we can do to make it better for both the soldier, the family, and the children, that's really our objective. So I want to thank your staff, Mr. Taylor, for helping out and leaning forward on this. It was very helpful to try to craft this thing, so okay. Thank you very much.
Maybe for your information, we have Representative Tomei and Representative Schaffler and myself have been on work groups for the last 6 years on dependency issues of kids. It's become kind of a focal point for us, and this fits in right with that, so we appreciate you bringing this forward.
Okay.
Committee members, do you have any questions? Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Sanssouci, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. You mentioned in your testimony about visitation. Does this bill, does it address grandparents or visitation and things like that?
The visitation portion is already in an Oregon statute, and I'm not an attorney, I'm sorry, and I don't know if it, I don't know, I would have to defer to someone else as to whether that includes grandparents in an Oregon statute. I'm sorry. I know that in other states it does, but I don't want to say yes if I'm not positive.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Wisenhut, I believe we changed that last session where we did add the grandparents. I can go back and check, but I'm pretty sure that we did because it was a matter in this committee.
They are a person who's to be looked at first for adoption, and we're not to the point where we're providing mandatory, as I recall, visitation, but the work group work we've got going, that's one of the things we are looking at.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and for you and Mr. Taylor, too, is I know we did that last session, but this is we're sort of suspending things for 90 days. So my question is, if we're suspending those things for 90 days, does this bill cover? You know, maybe there's feelings that they shouldn't have. You know, it's not a friendly situation that those grandparents would be able to visit during that 90-day period or keep that relationship. Is that addressed in this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my reading of the bill is that it doesn't impact grandparents one way or the other. It basically freezes in place the current status until the person who's on active military duty comes back. So if the grandparents had visitation rights, prior to going away or she going away, it would not impact that. If the grandparents were seeking visitation rights, that would impact
a deployed person, then I guess it would impact that.
They couldn't get a change.
Yeah.
Well, it would be difficult to get a change order, but you have to remember this area, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's been a while since I read it, but the U.S. Supreme Court, out of a case out of Washington, basically said that it's the parents' rights are paramount, the child's rights are paramount, and the grandparents take secondary to that. So it's a complicated area. But with my reading of the bill, this does not negatively impact directly grandparents.
Thank you.
And we are concerned about the grandparents' rights because today there are more grandparents raising their children outside of a court system because they just took them over. So it is important, and we'll be addressing it.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I spoke with Susan Gravy of the Oregon State Bar, who talked with the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, and they are fine with the bill.
Okay, good.
Otherwise, it
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Taylor, we have some dash ones. What do they do?
Chairman, members of the committee, the dash one amendment come to you from the administrator of the Division of Child Support for the Department of Justice. And basically, over in page two at the top first paragraph, they basically say that when the person returns from deployment, that the administrator of the Division of Child Support of the Department of Justice or a branch office will get notice of it as well as the court.
Okay, we need to put the bill, the amendments into the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think from an administrative viewpoint, it would be appropriate because they handle most of the child support matters and other matters like that in Oregon.
Okay.
And obviously a key player.
We will open the bill to a work session for the purpose of putting the amendments in.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3162.
Okay, Representative Tomei has moved the dash one amendments into House Bill 3162. Any objections? Not so ordered, and we'll close the work session on 3162. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3184.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3184 comes in from Representative Garrard and Huffman. And I know Representative Huffman was in another committee meeting and was planning to come up here. I said he'd be about 10 minutes late. Allows notice by publication of a public notice by broadcasting or posting on the Internet over a single website available statewide that is maintained by a statewide association of stations or broadcasters. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, right now publication by notice is done in a newspaper of general circulation in the location where the notice has been given.
You have a sign-up sheet, too?
That would help, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Representative Gerard?
Hoffman's in the back.
Co-chairs, committee members, thank you for hearing this bill today. I'm State Representative Bill Garrard, District 56. It was 50 years ago this year that I got my first job in a radio station as a real live broadcaster. There have been moments since then, while I've been in the legislature, that I wished I were back in broadcasting. But my comments today will be brief. 50 years ago, the issue of public notices only being allowed in newspapers was an issue. Here we are 50 years later, and it's still an issue. House Bill 3184 simply gives broadcasters the opportunity to compete. That's the extent of the bill. It takes nothing away from anybody. It simply gives broadcasters the opportunity and the same playing field. The dialogue between broadcasters and print that has been created by this bill, I find to be extremely healthy for both of our industries and long overdue. I thank the chairs for hearing this and happy to answer any questions after my colleague, Mr. Huffman.
Thank you, Bill. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm John Huffman, state rep for District 59, and I, too, was a broadcaster for a number of years. I'm not nearly as old as my colleagues, so therefore I couldn't have been in the business nearly as long. However, House Bill 3184 addresses a vehicle that delivers public notices. And In our discussion today, I would hope that we will remain focused on the integrity of the public interest and the public right to access of governmental notices, and that that interest is protected regardless of the method of conveying those notices. In the last couple of years, there have been some electronic media that has come about since the development of ink and paper, radio, television, and Mr. Gore's internet, that could possibly be used for the delivery of public notices, as long as, I think, a big question before the committee and in this public discussion is that the integrity of the notices and the archiving and those questions are held to a high standard, as newspaper has held them for so many years. That is the extent of my testimony, and thank you for your time.
Okay, committee members, you have some questions?
Only to say I find the internet a little more useful than some of the inconvenient truths.
Anything else?
Mr. Co-Chair, always difficult to follow my friend from Happy Valley. I'm curious about the provision in the bill that specifies a newspaper, a broadcast medium, or a website maintained by newspapers and broadcast. Why limit the website to something proprietary to business interests in media?
I don't think it has to, co-chairs and Representative Nolan. I think agencies have expressed some interest in being able to utilize some form of electronic media to post notices. And I think that will come out in the discussion with other testimony today. My concern is that we don't boil this down to an agency trying to hide, or anybody else for that fact, trying to hide a notice on some website to save a couple of dollars. And I don't think the discussion today should be about saving dollars or one entity or one medium making dollars and another not. I think it needs to be about the public notice and the integrity of that.
If I might follow up.
Follow up.
I think, Representative Huffman, you've hit a very important point, and I'd like to get your perspective and maybe other witnesses who will come forward about the transition period, because for years and years, people who have sought information in an official way about public notices, requests for proposal, contract awards, land use decisions, have known where to go. How do we assure that the transition is successful so that, in fact, the accountability and transparency isn't lost?
Co-chairs and Representative Nolan, one of the beauties of this bill is that at stake here is the reputation of media that have been famous for advertising for years and educating the public with their particular media. So I think within a reasonable period of time, and my hope is that my colleagues behind me would spend some time hammering out those details and coming back with a great proposal that says within time certain we will use all the force behind us to educate the public as to where they can find certain notices. I see some notices lending themselves well to newspaper and some notices lending themselves well to electronic. Hammering out those details, I don't think we're going to get that done today.
One final question. You again have raised a point that is something that I'm thinking about as I evaluate this. 50 years ago, Representative Garrard, as I was in kindergarten.
Thank you.
Newspapers were the primary place people got information. We didn't even have a television in my house at 50 years ago. We did have a radio. Now, there is no one place that you could point to that even a majority of people go to for their information. There is a range, and we've identified them, and 10 years from now, there will be
media where a significant portion of the population gets its information that probably we don't even know about today. So my question is, 50 years ago when we established the local newspaper of record as the place to publish notices, we could have some certainty that that was reaching the biggest portion of the population. If we now require notices only in one or another of these, how do we have any assurance that we're actually speaking to enough people where they get their information? Maybe we should require more than one.
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Donald, if John, if I can respond to that. And John and I have discussed this bill. One of the things we like about the bill is the fact that it opens the door to the dialogue that you're suggesting, mm-hmm. that it may be indeed a combination of these various industries that will handle one kind of public notice. Another may do a better job at handling another kind. But I think that's the dialogue that we're getting out there and discussing right now. But I totally agree that it's going to be a combination of these various media sources.
Done. Thanks.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have Dave Fiskum and Bill Johnstone come up, please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, which, as you'll hear in more detail in a moment, consists of more than 200 radio and television stations throughout the state, many of them small businesses in local communities. First, let me express our deep appreciation to Representative Bill Garrard and Representative John Huffman. Not only have they introduced this bill on our behalf at the specific request of the Association's Board of Directors, they also have worked with us to present what we think is a viable and important improvement in Oregon's public notice law. Thank you, co-chairs, for being to hear this bill. I'll be brief, so I can turn the microphone over to the President and CEO of the Association, Mr. Bill Johnstone, who is seated to my right. I do want to make just two quick comments for the record, as the documents are distributed to you that Mr. Johnstone will use for his testimony. First, this is a bill that allows radio and broadcast outlets throughout the state to participate in the process of getting public notices to the public. Building public awareness and public participation in government is an important goal. You've just heard that from the witnesses previous for you, for state and local governments, for the public, and indeed for our industries. This is an option, not a requirement, and thus I do not believe there is a fiscal impact on government associated with this bill. So my second point is the approach outlined in House Bill 3184 ends a monopoly on public notice advertising that our friends in the newspaper industry have enjoyed for many years. We believe the public interest is served by including radio and television stations as an option, and let me emphasize, it is an option for the placement of public notice advertising. So, Mr. Co-Chairs, with your indulgence and permission, I will turn to Mr. Johnstone for some further comments, and we'll be pleased at the end to answer your questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairs, Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, I'm Bill Johnstone. I'm President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and we do represent in excess of 200 radio stations and 27 television stations around the state. Today you're going to hear testimony from some who are in favor of House Bill 3184, like myself and Representatives Garrard and Huffman, and you'll hear some from some opposition to the bill. Those in favor of the bill are in favor of it because of what it can add to the public notice arena and how it gets information out to the public about the very important issues. And those opposed, perhaps, because of what it could take away from them. You'll also hear some testimony, perhaps, from some people who are simply turning to you for your wisdom and insight on how to correct perhaps an old and outdated verbiage in a statute. Years ago, long before there was radio, long before there was television, and certainly long before there was internet with an excess of 74% reach.
Yeah, don't leave the room.
That's how important this is.
come into Gold Beach another half an hour later.
Co-chairs, thank you very much. I want to thank Tom Gallagher for getting us out for a little bit of an exercise here. Thanks for pulling that alarm. I was commenting about the fact that there was newspaper that did a great job. Radio was added, television was added, and now internet is added. And according to latest figures, which I believe is 2008, the latest figures out from the state show that in excess of 74% of the state now can receive information on the internet. So there have been a lot of changes, and there will continue to be changes. And we think it's time that this is time for one of those changes to be made, and that is this particular bill.
Excuse me, could you please put your name on the record one more time?
Oh, sir, I'm sorry. Bill Johnstone, Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Thank you. When communities many years ago moved from the town crier, walking along the walls, to the newspaper, there was this, probably some conversation about the fact that this new innovative idea probably wouldn't catch on. Well, obviously it did. And so there have been some significant changes. Well, since that time, there's also been added radio and television. And I'm sure that there was some conversation, as we've already heard this morning, whether that is going to catch on. And I can assure you that it has. And now we've added again the internet. In the days before, communities were smaller, far less diverse than they are today. We need something that reaches more people. What hasn't changed is the fact that public notices and legal notices that are required to be publicized are still mandated to be printed in the newspapers who have experienced somewhat of a decrease in readership. At that same time, radio and television has experienced an increase in listenership and is certainly the internet. Public notice that are put in newspapers to those that are not familiar with the process perhaps could be found to be a bit boring because people don't know what they're looking for. And I will come back to Representative Nolan's question that she asked earlier as I get finished here. There is a need for more people to be involved and be aware of more events that are happening in their communities, and we feel that House Bill 3184 can address that. There is a website already established that the newspapers in Oregon subscribe to, that where they put the information that is printed in the newspaper. We, the broadcasters, also own actually four different websites that could be dedicated for this purpose. To say that there needs to be five different or six different websites doesn't really make a lot of sense. And we certainly would work with the newspapers and with the state government to come up with a website that would be the website that would be used for public notice. Also to achieve archivism as well. There are to put public notices today in the paper is expensive. And I'm not saying that it's not. There is a question about trying to save some money for the state. My suggestion is that if and when, hopefully, House Bill 3184 passes and there is now an opportunity for competition, that as is always the case, typically always the case, when there is competition, perhaps these costs will go down. At the same time, there's a great opportunity that more people will be more involved and be more aware of the events that are going on if these notices are broadcast on both radio and on television, and you have the voice of radio and television promoting and moving people toward the website that can give you all of the facts. Now,
I can tell you that the radio and television broadcasters are not going to broadcast every public notice word for word. We would be out of business in a week because we wouldn't have any listeners, wouldn't have any viewers. But were we to use a 30-second or a 60-second advertisement, perhaps in a 30 using two 10-second teasers about events that are happening, and using the final portion of that commercial for direction to a website where they can get all the viewers, listeners can get all of the information about that at their leisure, read it, and in fact drive people to that website, I would suggest that you're going to get more people involved in what is going on. That's not what's happening now. It has all of the information anyone could ever want about a public notice is in the newspaper, and that's which is fine. It's there. But how many people go and visit it? It's very much like the joke used to be in 1949 that everybody knew there was a country called Australia, but how many people ever got a chance to go there? Well, it's pretty much the same way right now. We can, broadcasters can direct people there. Final thought, that it's time for the monopoly that the newspapers enjoy for public notice to come to a close, and for the broadcasters to have an opportunity to, as Representative Huffman voiced earlier, be a part of that voice on the public notice. So with that, I would like to address, if I may, Co-Chair, Representative Nolan, you had spoken earlier about how would people go there? How would you make all this happen? Hopefully I have addressed that. With the addition of the broadcasters as an either or, because in our bill it's going to be, you'd have a choice. You could pick radio, you could pick television, you could pick newspapers, but the option that we're proposing is that there would be no additional charge to put that on the website, to put it on the internet, and the broadcasters would, as you would be participating with us, we would be participating with you and directing people to that website. So, our co-chairs, I would thank you for your time and would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, committee? Representative Nolan?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm trying to imagine. I can imagine how public notices get published in a newspaper. I've seen them. I've placed them when I ran public agencies. I know how that works. I can imagine because I've also seen them on websites. I have a tough time imagining any substantive public notice being actually published in a radio broadcast or a television broadcast. Can you walk me through how you might publish a notice for a request for proposals on the reconstruction of a segment of highway?
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, I'm sorry, I didn't voice myself very well the last time, I guess. My suggestion is that we would not publish that entire public notice on either radio or television. We would make note of the fact that there is this bid for due, this bid is up for bid. I didn't say that very well, but I hope you know what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of that information, every bit of that information that was originally published in the newspaper, and if they use newspaper at the same time, it probably still would be there. But the point is, we would draw people, hopefully get some excitement going about the fact that it's there. I don't know how many people are going to get excited about a bid for a highway, as many people perhaps as it would be on the school closure.
Concrete finishers.
Okay.
Okay. You know, iron workers, they're going to get pretty excited about it.
Okay, okay. The goal would be to get those people interested in it, and then direct them to the website where they would find that information. I know there has been some suggestions that the state government would have their own website, which would be fine, except that if no one knows the website is there, how many people are going to go to the website? That's why the addition of the broadcast element will make everything you're already doing better, and with the element of competition could very well make it less expensive. Mr. Co-Chairs, with your indulgence, let me just add a quick comment to Representative Nolan, if I might. One of the kinds of issues I've imagined in this with regard to House Bill 3184 is a surplus property sale in a county or a city or a state government. And it would be fairly easy for me to imagine that a teasing, if that's the right word, brief information, 10, 20 seconds about this ability to go and compete for the purchase of surplus property on the courthouse steps or some other location, whether it's car sales or other kinds of equipment, would be available. And you could tease people, listeners on the radio, to go to the website for more specific information and all the details, which might appear in a newspaper column. So I think the point we're trying to make is that if you think about those kinds of examples, be it the highway construction bid or the surplus property sale or the community meeting on school closures or school budgets or whatever it is where public notices are required, be possible to mention the topic with from some standpoint of interest to the listeners and steer people by such mentions, such ads on the radio or on the television to the website for more specific information. And as Mr. Johnstone said, the penetration rate for the internet today in Oregon is almost 75%. So you're going to be gaining awareness. You're going to be creating public awareness by such a mechanism. And what we've said all along is that some kinds of public notices are better for broadcast than others, just as some kinds of public notice, the meets and bounds of property descriptions, for example, would be clearly better in the newspaper, and perhaps there's a way for both to steer interested parties to a website. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have Steve Clark, Mark Gaber, Pepper, and Jeff Wedding.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee, for giving us the opportunity to respond to this. This is a topic that newspaper people feel very passionate about. We have a number of newspaper publishers in the audience. I'm just going to read off some of the people who made the trip over to...
What's your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mark Garber, and I'm executive editor of the Portland Tribune and Community Newspapers, which is a group of 17 newspapers in the Portland area. It's a job that also includes being publisher of the Gresham Outlook and a couple of other papers. Steve Clark is the president of the Portland Tribune and Community Newspapers, and Jeb Ledeen is the publisher of the McMinnville News Register. In the audience, we have Mac Stinchfield, who's the publisher of the Condon Times Journal, Rennie Henderson, who's the publisher of the Daily Journal of Commerce, Angela Fox, who's the publisher of the Clackamas Review and Oregon City News, Mike McAnally of Corvallis Gazette Times, Chris Loretta of Albany Democrat Herald and the Lebanon Express, Al Harrigus of Newburgh Graphic, Mark Kaplan, also of the Daily Journal of Commerce, Joel Summer of the Curry County Reporter, Dave Baker of the Eugene Register Guard, Lyndon Zeitz of the Kaiser Times, and Gordon Black and John Costa of the Ben Bulletin. So we have a number of people who made the trip over here. I just want to talk just a little bit about newspapers and what we do, and then we have some research that we want to share about public notices, and I'll try to be brief. One of the things about newspapers, and all the newspapers that we just talked about, as well as the other newspapers that are members of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, which is 80-plus newspapers, are newspapers of record. And so we report in our pages when people are born, when they get engaged, when they're married, when they die, we print their obituaries. You know, we cover the city councils in those communities. We cover the school boards. We're the ones, and I know several people here have served on school boards and city councils and that sort of thing. And if you think about who was sitting in the room, sometimes the only person there was a reporter from the community newspaper. And so we sit through the four-hour meetings, and we pay the reporters to do that. You won't see other media doing that because it's not what they do best. There are some things that newspapers do best, and there's some things that other media do best. And we don't see this as a fight between the broadcasters and newspapers. It's just a recognition that we're better capable of doing some things than they are. So what sort of come from that, from this dedication that we have to being the newspaper of record for our communities, is that people have come to expect that they're going to see those things in our newspapers. They come to expect that they'll see public notices about governmental actions that are important to them. And so we think that that's where they should stay. This question that I hadn't really thought about this before, I heard the broadcasters' representatives say that newspapers have a monopoly, and I just want to kind of diffuse that a little bit. Every county in this state, newspapers compete for public notices. If you're in Multnomah County, where the Gresham Outlook's located, you can place a public notice in the Gresham Outlook. You can place it in the Oregonian. You can place it in the Daily Journal of Commerce. If you're in Clackamas County, there's probably 12 or 14 community newspapers in Clackamas County where you could place a public notice. We compete. All of these folks who are here compete with each other for public notices. So there is very great sensitivity to price. And if public agencies feel that they're being overcharged, then they let us know, and they let us know that they can shop that around. The broadcasters also have talked about expanding the number of people that would see public notices, but their bill actually says that you'll either place the public notice in a newspaper or you'll place it on a radio or TV station. I was going to take some time and actually read you a public notice and what it would sound like on the air, but since they've already conceded that they don't plan to put public notices on the air, I think we can sort of dispense with that. There's no way that you're going to be able to read a public notice on the air, and there are very, very few public notices that are less than 180 words, which is the limit that they set for the ones that can be placed on the air. So what they're really talking about is placing them on the internet. And, you know, what we feel is that people need to have actual notice. That's what the law says, you know, that they have actual notice. If it's in the newspaper, there's a chance that if there's a zoning decision that's occurring in your neighborhood, that someone in your neighborhood is going to see that notice, and they're going to stand up and they're going to go, wait a minute, I think I better go down to City Hall and find out more about this. I don't think that person, if they hear a 10-second or a 20-second teaser on the radio that the city of Gresham or the city of Beaverton or whoever it might be is planning to have a zoning hearing, that they're going to run out and check a website to find that out. We know from our own experience that it takes years and years to build any kind of audience for a website. So what would occur in the beginning, you know, as Representative Nolan mentioned, is that people wouldn't be going to that website. They wouldn't know about it. So what would happen if something occurred that they disagreed with and they come along a year later and say, where was the notice? They're going to feel that they didn't get notice. So for us, it's a matter of good public policy that the notices be placed in some form of media that they can see it. You know, that brings me a little bit to the research that we've done. People expect the public notices to be in newspapers, and they also want them to be there. OMPA spent thousands of dollars to do some research around this question, and we hired American Opinion Research, and they did 600 phone interviews across Oregon. And we have the study here, which we can make available to the committee. But just some highlights. More than 8 in 10 Oregonians say that keeping the public informed through public notice advertising is an important requirement for government agencies. More than half, 51% of those surveyed said that they prefer receiving public notices through their newspaper. 30% said that they preferred mail. Only 15% preferred the internet. And they also assign a much greater credibility for public notices that are placed in newspapers versus those found on websites. I think you have in your information there a letter from the AARP. AARP opposes this bill, and their letter states that 57% of adults age 65 and older do not use the internet. So if the public notice is put into a radio, TV, internet plan as proposed by the broadcasters, it would be to the detriment of a large percentage of the population. And just I know from my own personal experience that the people who tend to read public notices tend to be in that age category. And so I think we'd be cutting out a big portion of our audience if we went to a web-only plan. The other thing that we feel strongly about is that public notices should be able to be archived and that they should be a permanent record of what's happened. And so if someone places a public notice and they need to be able to prove, of course they'll have the affidavit, but if they need to be able to prove a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the line that the public notice was placed, then we have that record. All newspapers keep copies, bound copies, of, and anyone can go and check. The broadcaster's bill says that they will keep an archive for 6 months. You know, we have newspapers that have archives going back 150 years. So we feel that this permanence of the record, the fact that it's in print, is important. So I'm going to turn it over to Steve Clark, who's going to talk a little bit about just how robust the readership of Oregon newspapers is. And then we'll follow with Jeb Bledin, who will talk about the cooperation that newspapers have engaged in with the public agencies over this issue. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, joint chairs and members of the committee. I am Steve Clark. I'm president of the Portland Tribune and Community Newspapers. Community Newspapers makes up 17 newspapers in four counties, including, for example, the Beaverton Valley Times, the Lake Oswego Review, and a number of other newspapers, the Selwood Bee and the Clackamas Review. For many years, I've had the pleasure of working with some of you and members of the legislature on issues such as highway finance and land use matters, economic development in a state that relies on its income tax to supply essential services. But today I'm here to talk to you about the importance of government agency transparency, about accountability, and about how we as a state provide that through public notice advertising. While your committee and the Oregon legislature is engaged in highly significant and pressure-packed decisions about budget shortfalls, the funding of essential services, job creation, significant public safety, and judicial matters, you're here today and we're talking about the essence of transparency and effective communication with Oregonians. Effectiveness, accountability, and transparency are not just words. They are a requirement, and they are a process that we should never change arbitrarily or without clear and measured outcomes in mind, and not simply about the monetary world of the economy in which we engaged. And certainly, we should never make changes without clear and confident measures and assurances that desired outcomes can and will be achieved. In my opinion, when it comes to accountably informing and engaging the public, this is not a time to whimsically alter what is working and, in fact, getting better. Just this week, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group announced that Oregon's own public budget transparency has improved to a rank among the nation's highest. A year ago, we were among the nation's lowest. House Bill 3184 opens the door to allow government agencies to decide, frankly, without the same basis that you decide today, whether to use newspapers, broadcast, radio, television, or web postings to communicate, or possibly, as we heard today, to negotiate how they might be communicated. Yet in making these allowances, this proposed legislation provides no assurance that effective communication with Oregonians or with government transparency will be improved, or conversely, how it might be impaired. For decades, Oregon newspapers have been judged by the public, and as you heard from Mark Garber, by groups such as AARP, as the most effective and most trusted and widest form of communication about the activities and decisions of government. That's why you folks come to talk to us when you're running for office, to learn about the issues, to converse in a dialogue, and to move forward to improve a community. Oregon newspapers do this work very well every day of the week, regardless if they are a printed daily newspaper or a weekly newspaper. And they do it with robust online newspapers. These include the listings of public notice, the web listings of public notice placed in print edition newspapers. And as you've heard today, we do this in partnership, not our own web postings, but we do this in partnership with the web service of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. To be clear, Oregon's web, or ONPA's website, is a compilation of public notices throughout the state of Oregon. That already exists today. It provides 24-hour access, 7 days a week, to statewide notices about hearings, advertisements for bids, financial reports, adoption of ordinances, and other government activities that legally require public notice. Chairs, members of the committee, this is already what happens today. Thanks to the efforts and the investment of Oregon's many weekly and daily newspapers, it is this kind of effort and the efforts of this legislature, state agencies, and local agencies that is improving the status of how the public perceives our transparency and accountability. Yet imagine, frankly, just throwing all of those processes away, negotiating them in some undisclosed manner. Supporters of House Bill 3184, including broadcasters, suggest that using radio and television promotional spots as teasers to drive people to go to their websites. That's the basis of this. Let's tease people to go somewhere. I must ask, what website? Or as we heard today, what four websites? What time will the broadcasters, radio and television stations commit to run these spots? I understand there's a range of time between 6 and 10 p.m., I might imagine that some of you, like I, have participated in community service radio programming that is required by or has been required in the past by FCC. You know, you're excited to appear on some communication program about some issue in your community. Those are generally broadcast on Sunday morning when you or I are at church, or at 9 o'clock on Sunday night when we're trying to capture what happened to our NCAA bracket. If this is what happens to House Bill, or as a result of House Bill 3184, then, folks, we're going to make it even harder for the public to engage, be communicated with, in the public proceedings of state government, local government. Transparency, accountability will be diminished, not improved. Meanwhile, think about how will Oregonians know what radio station or what television station to rely on for this public content. As many of you may know, there are more than 36 radio stations in the Portland metropolitan area. There are as many as 6 commercial television stations in the Portland area. That's a lot of fragmentation. That doesn't just exist in Portland. In Klamath Falls, for example, there are 17 broadcast stations that serve that community. Not all are specifically located there. The Medford reach is quite extensive. 6 TV stations, 11 radio stations serve the Klamath Falls area. Contrast that with Ontario. In Malheur County, there's 1 AM radio station. Television stations that serve that community are located in another state, Boise, Idaho. Yet research indicates that 85.6% of the people who live in Malheur County rely on their local newspaper to serve them with this essential public service. As you can see by the provisions of House Bill 3184, offering 3 or more choices for public agencies to decide, but without specific requirement as they have today, to disseminate public notices actually is going to engage in a fragmentation of public understanding, public engagement, and access to essential activities of state, regional, and local government. The public will no longer have the go-to source and the chance for a typical citizen, not a wonk like myself, to stumble on this information is going to be greatly diminished. Oregon newspapers continue to be the very best, and frankly, in my opinion, and it's not about a monopoly, the singular format for effective distribution of this kind of important service. And we do that not only in printed newspapers, but we do this and have for more than a decade in the very effective and growing websites that we utilize individually and with ONPA. In closing, I believe the changes proposed by House Bill 3184 do not match the breadth of public disclosure, coverage, distribution, and promotion provided today by Oregon newspapers, things that already exist and that are in place. This bill does not reduce the cost of public notice advertising, nor does it accountably improve public agents' transparency. I would ask you to ask the question, is this bill about distribution, or is it about public information? Is it about public engagement, or is it about advertising? If it's about distribution, about promotion, it's about advertising. It's not about engagement. It's not about public notice. It's about money. I appreciate your time and consideration on a Friday afternoon. Thank you very much.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jeb Bladeen. I'm president of the News Register Publishing Company in McMinnville, a longtime member of ONPA Association and Government Affairs Committee. Before making my principal point, I'd like to touch on two issues that have been raised earlier today. The first one is this concept of monopoly, which I want to make sure that we don't get this mixed up with the kind of monopoly that is the only possibility. There is no law that prevents any kind of notice from being placed on a radio or TV station or on any internet website or any way that government wishes to communicate to its public. There is a law saying that you have to at least put it in the place where people are traditionally used to looking for it, and that is in their community newspapers. The second point is the issue of where people go for their information. And while newspapers probably have slightly less circulation than they have at one time, during that same period of time, I don't know about you, but at my house we have 250 channels. We have access to millions of websites, but we still have one newspaper. And one of the things that we know is the people who care about local government go to their local newspaper because that is the only real source of in-depth news about their local community and the actions of their government. I always like to. We did a real interesting survey in our town in McMinnville and actually throughout Yamhill County, and we asked people if they think we have good city government, and we asked them if we think we have good schools. And we found out that 67% of our readers in a random survey said, we think we have good government, and 33% said, we don't think so. The numbers were exactly reversed for non-readers. 67% said, we don't think we have good government. 33% said, we think we do. I think this could be replicated across the state, the point being the people that care about local government go to their local newspaper and know that these important public notices will be there. And as the other two testifiers have said, those notices are also on a statewide website. It's been real interesting during this process to see the surprise on people's faces that there is a statewide website with all of these legal notices. A number of people, I think, in the course of discussion of 3184 have perhaps looked up that website, which most of our newspapers have prominently displayed on our websites and which is easily accessible. But I think that sort of speaks to how well the internet works as a place where people will go for legal notices. It's not put in front of them. They have to proactively go there as opposed to the local community newspaper that they purchase and read cover to cover, and they find the notices, and those that care about local government read them there. My principal point, though, in this testimony is the issue of the developing relationship that an ongoing and really a decades old, but recently more developing relationship between Oregon newspapers and local government on improving public notice. I've part of a contingent of people from ONPA that spent the last 18 months on a workforce working with representatives of all local governments, school districts, special districts of Oregon on the issue of municipal budget publications, probably the single largest local public notice that there is for most of the public bodies in Oregon that they place in newspapers. At the conclusion of that, this group, with 100% concurrence, brought a bill to the legislature that is currently going before the legislature to significantly reduce the size and scope of those published legal notices, to significantly reduce the cost to a lot of government, most of the local governments, for placing those, and in our opinion, to improve the actual notice to the public. It was a long, drawn-out process. It was a process that took a lot of give and take. You know, obviously, the newspapers were not anxious to go in and say, oh, let's just eliminate most of this public notice. But we recognize that a lot of the content in that notice was
a little bit indecipherable to people, and we favored improving it, improving the format, improving the look, improving the user friendliness of these legal notices. So I think this is just indicative of the common interest that community newspapers throughout Oregon and local government have in reaching the public. Again, nothing prevents local government from using any means they wish to reach the public, and they do so. They use direct mail. We sell them additional space in our newspapers to reach the public in more ways than just their required legal notices. Certainly, broadcast is welcome to sell local government on the idea of informing the public through broadcast. But I think this is really not about informing the people through broadcast. If that were the case, we would have addressed this issue 50 years ago when there was radio far before that. But some of us remember when there wasn't TV. But it came to my house about 1953 or 54. But we would have put these on the radio or on the TV 50 years ago or 40 years ago or 25 years ago or 10 years ago, but it hasn't been an issue. I think this is about Internet, and it's about an interest in another medium and sort of getting a piece of the pie, I think, and getting these onto an Internet system that they would control as opposed to how they're placed now. I don't think this issue is about sharing revenue. It's about responsible, verifiable, permanently verifiable public notice and serving the public. I think that's what community newspapers do, and we appreciate the relationship we have with local government in doing that. And I also thank you for your time on a Friday afternoon.
Okay, committee members, any questions? Guess not. Thank you. We have Carol Summers, Ray Gillis, and Alex Cato. Please.
Race your back to Gold Beach.
Well, at first blush, that as much as newspaper people talk, they should have been broadcasters.
That's right.
That's absolutely true.
Wants to be first.
Yeah, my name is Joel Summer. I'm the publisher of the Curry County Reporter in Gold Beach, Oregon, the land of tsunamis. I wanted to just discuss briefly what it's like in a rural community. I could tell you one thing. Curry County is a rural community, beautiful community, but rural, and we probably have the highest percentage of senior citizens of any county in the state of Oregon. I can tell you one thing, this bill as proposed will do nothing but confuse the heck out of the folks here in our county. I think you heard from one of the previous speakers that our position on this bill. The fact of the matter is that I can tell you for a fact, because these people who are usually marching in our offices the day after our publication, they do not look at the internet. They read our paper, and they read every word of our paper, including the public notices. All this bill will do, if it was to be passed, will just confuse all of these readers. They will have no idea of where to look for legal notices. And these are legal notices. They're not just teasers. They're not just other kinds of public information. They have to meet certain legal requirements. And our staff takes a huge amount of effort to make sure that that happens each and every time. We work with, for instance, the county government to make sure that the legal notices are printed in a size that our senior citizens could actually read. I don't know how many times you've seen legal notices on internets or whatever else, but I can tell you that, you know, right along with old age comes poor vision, and our people take a close look at those legal notices. And to say, And I can tell you another thing about our legal notices, whether they're foreclosure notices, whether they're notice of bids, whether they're budgets. The people in our community, honest to God, read every word of those legal notices. And they read them more than one time. Because those same people who look at the budgets for the county or for the city of Gold Beach or for the school district will be at those meetings, and they will have been very well versed on what the school district is asking for, what the county is asking for, how much money is available for this, whether it's Title II or whether it's Title III. They have all of these things, and they know it very well. So we go out of our way to make sure that those notices are readable, that they, and we will even go to the extent that if we decide that they've got to be a certain size in order to be readable, we'll eat the extra cost. If we have to go, for instance, to three columns instead of two columns or make the font size bigger, it takes up more space. But we will, you know, we will still give our folks the rate at the lower rate because, you know, we feel like we have a responsibility to our readership. They need to know what's in those notices. The other thing is, in a rural community, maybe more so than an urban community, is that these are our friends and neighbors. When we put a foreclosure notice in, for instance, it's that person down the street who's having his house foreclosed. So we go out of our way to do this stuff in the proper legal way and in the most humane way. And then, as you have heard a number of times, and I can tell you this, we are one of the publications, of course, who have our legal notices uploaded by the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. It is on their website, and I can tell you how well that website runs. It is now to the point where our customers go to that website and download the information that they need to for their own legal requirements. It used to be a time, and we still do this for maybe the majority of our customers, but in addition to an affidavit, of course, that says we publish this on these dates, we give them a tear sheet. And the tear sheet says, you know, it's a copy, it's an actual page out of the newspaper that shows that it's been published. Now our customers don't ask for a tear sheet. They know to go to the ONPA site, and they know to download it off of there, that they will be accurate every time, that they and these folks are in the business. You know, they are they know they have to meet legal requirements. They know where to go each and every time. They know that they'll be accurate. And they rely on the ONPA website now to get that information. I can guarantee you that, you know, if the broadcasters think they can put out some internet site, no one's going to have any idea in Curry County where to go. I can also tell you that, you know, unlike metropolitan areas, we just have a few radio stations. The television stations are in Medford and Coos Bay, in Eureka, California, in Klamath Falls. We have a internet provider that, you know, depending on whether there's a storm or anything else, you may or may not get a television station. I have no idea who got kicked off American Idol last night because Charter was on the fritz. There are other issues as well. The radio stations only work insofar as you're driving down the coast highway and all of a sudden you're in a mountainous area and all you have is static. So they're not very reliable forms of communication, at least not in southwest Oregon. So, again, we take care. We take tremendous care to make sure that the information gets out in a readable way, in a way that people can rely on, that they always know where to go, they always read it thoroughly, and then it goes to the ONPA site where they absolutely have confidence in that site. Thank you.
Gentlemen, we've got six bills to go here, so try to be a little brief, please.
I will. My name is Greg Jenks. I live in Milwaukee, Oregon. I'm here representing not only myself, but my friends down at the Daily Journal of Commerce in Portland, Oregon. They asked me to come today to share what is essentially a lay perspective, as someone who's used our current public notice system from a variety of perspectives. In the interest of time, I've detailed those out in my written testimony. But I do want to concur with the last speaker. I've spent a career in economic development, mostly in the rural parts of the state, and I want to concur with everything he just said. Radio does not serve everywhere. When you come down 101, I've been in that position many times. Real quickly, as the purchaser of public notice services, both as a public employee and an attorney, there is no monopoly. I just want to be very clear about that. It's very price competitive. As an attorney, I would pick and choose where I got my service, depending on the facts of the case, and to provide actual notice to the public. Real quick, I think that our public notice system is working quite well. And I both from being bombarded by the senior citizens that read the public notice section religiously as a public employee, and I'm here to at least sing the praises of it a little bit. All of the newspapers that I work with also have very detailed websites. And when I was a marketing director, having to travel quite a bit, that was instrumental in trying to track government activity, because a lot of times I'd be on the road and I just wouldn't be getting my hard copy. These community papers are local businesses who've made investments over time in partnership with the requirements of their government partners. And they do it very well. In preparation for the hearing today, we actually did a little test to see if we were as good as we thought we were. And we Googled Oregon Public Notice. And the first four hits that came up on Google are the website undertaken by the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. Out of approximately 435,000 results. I think that speaks to how well the system works. If you want to obtain public notices via internet, there it is. We have included in your packet a copy of that Google search, as well as a copy of what folks will see when that website comes up. I would encourage you to proceed with extreme caution for any changes in our public notice system. As someone has used it both in the public and the private sector, it works very well, and Oregon is well served by its current public notice system.
Co-Chairs Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. The Board of County Commissioners has examined this bill. In the end, they could not get all the way to support. They asked me to continue monitoring the bill. I will give you 3 points as to the experience that county commissioners sort of have when they're involved with public notice. The first is really the first order of business at the beginning of every year is to choose a newspaper of general circulation. I can recall 2 years ago there was a debate about which newspaper to choose. There were several attorneys from each paper in the room at the time, and you can just imagine the tension that the commissioners felt as they sort of debated what general circulation meant and the implications for their decision that day. What was led them further during that decision was the presence of the assessor. The assessor puts in many legal notices into the newspaper And if you look at ORS 311, you'll see why our assessor was so concerned, especially with regards to tax warrants, which have to be very, very particular, as a previous speaker mentioned. And certainly there's no way they're going to fit 180 characters. That was another thing that came up in our discussion. And I just close with the discussion that the board members did have on this bill, is that more choice is not necessarily better. As people are relying on getting their notices about different things the government is doing, certainly the county does not want to be in a position of being accused of sort of trying to hide public notice in one publication one time and a different medium another time. So that was some of the concerns that were expressed. I'll continue to watch the bill. Thank you.
Main members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really enjoy my newsprint. I love to read my newspaper early in the morning with coffee, and I'm having a hard time transitioning from this to that. But you know what? We're watching the change transform before our eyes, and I don't think this bill is going to happen. I don't know. I haven't canvassed committee, but from what I hear, it may not happen. But when my daughter is her grandmother's age, she will not have newsprint, and she will have this. That it's going to happen someday. And this is about business and who gets the money and who gets to distribute the notification. And I understand that completely. But whether people are confused or not, this is where it's going, and it's just a reality. But and I do not look forward to the day in my life when I read public notifications. Not once, but twice. That doesn't sound very fun. And Happy Valley, I believe, we have a website, and I think all this stuff is on there, even though our legal public publisher is, I think we have to do it in the Clackamas Review. It was when I was on City Council. It is. So I'm not against newsprint. I love newsprint, but you know what? It's like you're a bunch of blacksmith here fighting for the buggy instead of the automobile. I hate to say it, but I think it's true. But keep up the good work. Thanks.
Being as I have one of my publishers here, I can't let him off too easy, because I had been watching you carefully, and you used the word senior several times in large font, and every time you did, you were looking at me. Okay, thank you for your...
Yeah, look a big man for you.
We'll close the public hearing on 3481. Session on House Bill 2272.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill, House Bill 2272 comes to you from Representative Kotak. You have the dash two amendments in front of you. It gives the court-appointed special advocate the power to consult with as well as inspect and copy the records of the child that are in possession of an agency, hospital, school organization, doctor, nurse, psychologist, psychiatrist, police department, and mental health clinic. The dash two amendments just basically clarify the language as it relates to that particular section, Mr. Chairman, of me. They go to page 2 and line 10 and
2272.
Okay. Chairman of the committee, the bill has no expenditure.
Mr. Taylor, I'm sorry. Can you pump it up a little bit?
Yeah, here you have it.
Okay. Well, I'll start again.
Not needed. Just pump it up a little when you're moving on.
Okay. Mr. Chairman of the committee, you have the dash two amendments in front of you. You have the staff measure summary. The dash two amendments basically clarify the language as it relates to what the special court special advocate can get. It has no fiscal. We have the fiscal in front of us. Everything's ready to go if you choose. You would have to adapt the dash two amendments. So.
Committee, is that a good enough explanation of the dash two? You're satisfied with that?
Want to make a motion on the dash twos?
On the 2272.
We'll put it right in there.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2272 be introduced.
Representative Barker has moved the dash two amendments into House Bill 2272. Any objections? House ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2272 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Barker, move House Bill 2272 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Mr. Chair, I don't have in front of me the fiscal on that. If it's just a minimal fiscal, I don't need a piece of paper. Do we have confirmation that it's...
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I...
De minimis fiscal?
We have the fiscal, yes.
Okay. Thanks.
It should be. It's
I don't need the piece of paper.
It's actually no expenditure, no
okay.
revenue impact.
Perfect.
It's probably on your S drive, I think. I'm not sure.
What
are as germane to the previous conversation, there are those of us who really prefer paper.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm in that category, too. So.
Want to call the roll, please?
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Excuse.
Representative
Shoplet?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei?
Aye.
Representative
Wong?
Aye.
Representative Whitman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Garrett?
He's excused. Co-Vice Chair
Hicks?
He's also excused.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye. This bill 2272 moves to the floor with a due pass. I'll carry the bill.
Or perhaps one of the sponsors.
Who's
Representative Kotek is the chief sponsor. I don't know if she didn't ask whether she wanted to, but.
It's a simple bill. I'll let her step in.
Okay.
So Representative Kotek will be the carrier?
No, I'll carry it, but I'll have her. If she wants to say it, I think she can. Okay, open a work session on House Bill 2687.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2687 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section. Requires a person ordered to pay temporary spousal support to pay the other party rather than the clerk of the court administrator, or the Department of Justice. Allows a court to approve the amount of temporary child support or spousal support requested after commencement of the suit in the general judgment. Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash two amendments in front of you. They're basically clarifying amendments as it relates to language. Talks about a general judgment entered under section. They include the amount of support, et cetera. Dash two, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill has no expenditure, no revenue.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2687 to the floor with a due pass.
Need to move the dash two into it
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I move the dash twos to House Bill 2687.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2687.
I have a question, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Taylor, was the family law section of the Oregon State Bar consulted on the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Wan, these amendments come from the family law section of the Oregon State Bar.
Thank you. No objection.
Any other questions? Amendments are in. Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2687 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2687 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Miller?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffer?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wong?
Aye.
Representative Woodman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
He's excused.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Aye. Who would like to carry it? Anybody?
I'll take it.
Sure.
Okay. We're going to skip for a minute out of order, and we'll go down to House Bill 2714. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2714 comes to you from Representative Tomei. It creates the crime of patronizing a prostitute if a person pays her office to pay a fee to another in order to engage in a sex act, classifies the crime as a Class A misdemeanor, sets a fine of $20,000 if the person to whom the fee was offered was under 18, does not require the state to prove the person knew the person whom offered was under 18. If the court determines the defendant is unable to pay $20,000, allows the court to impose a fine that the court determines the defendant can pay, prohibits the court from waiving or suspending the fine, amends the prostitution statute to only include the person offering to engage in sex act for a fee. Mr. Chairman of the committee, you have the dash two amendments in front of you, which lower the penalty. First offense, mandatory fine of $10,000. Second offense, mandatory fine of $20,000. Third and subsequent offense, $20,000 and at least 30 days in jail. Chair, members of the committee, the bill has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Representative Torme.
Bill, my memory is not what it used to be, but whose amendment was this? Was that mine?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Torme, you may remember discussion that you had with the legislators on the Senate side concerning a similar bill in the Senate committee and general discussion around this particular
right,
issue.
Right. Indeed, we did. I guess Section C about an imposition of thirty days on the third conviction, because it seems to me that we were avoiding that because it would carry a fiscal. But you're saying this has no fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, members of committee, it has no fiscal to the state.
Okay.
And that's how a fiscal impact statement is analyzed.
It would be at the county level. Wouldn't it?
Chair, members of committee, it would be an impact at the county level. That's correct.
It's because you're treating it as a Class A misdemeanor.
Chair, members of committee, it's an A misdemeanor. That all misdemeanors are handled at the county level. All felonies are state responsibility, even if they're handled at the local level, because the state will then reimburse the county.
And I would expect that after somebody paid $10,000 once and $20,000 the next time, they'd get the clue, and we wouldn't have to give them 30 days later on.
So,
hopefully. I think that's likely.
Representative Olson?
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just Representative Tomei.
Yes.
You're okay with this, then? I mean, truthfully, I kind of like the progression of this, but I mean, this is your bill.
We had discussion with staff and Jeff and I, and there was a desire by some people that had come to us that we'd like to see this type of a breakdown rather than just as the bill was, and we had the bill, the amendments drafted.
Okay, thank you for that, because I was feeling like I was really losing my memory. So because I don't remember seeing this. But we did have another amendment that I think did come from that meeting that we had in the Senate, and that was the -1 amendment that would, because the original bill would have had the publication of the offender's picture on the internet. The -1 amendment would have changed that, would have fined the person $20,000, and then on a second offense, then the photograph and the name of the person would be on the internet.
I don't think I have a copy of the -1s. Anyone else have them?
I don't.
Were they just discussed but not put into drafting?
No, I've got the amendment.
They had been drafted in order for there to be a...
Yeah, I've got the amendment, but nobody else does.
Mr. Chair, maybe you want to take a recess on this to give Representative Tomei... I mean, I'll follow your lead, but...
Let's just take a quick recess if the four of us could meet. Would that be okay?
I'd rather hold it over and take care of that.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to do that too and read what Representative.
Okay.
I don't want to get
it all right with everybody. That we'll get it right.
Sure.
Okay. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2714, and then let's get people together and make sure we got the amendments right. And then if there is an amendment different than what we've got, we do not have a fiscal for that. Fiscal's on the -2, not on the -1, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So then we'd have to wait to get the fiscal on the -2. Is that correct? Am I understanding that?
On the one you have.
I mean on the -1, because the fiscal's on the -2.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3100.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3100 comes to you from Representative Clem. You have a whole series of amendments, 1 through 6, but I understand that the moving parties in this would prefer that you look at the original bill, and that requires that a person pleading not guilty except for insanity file with the court a report from the psychiatrist or psychologist who has been certified by the Oregon Health Authority, requires the authority to adopt rules to certify these people, requires the defendant to file a report with court prior to trial, allows the court to accept a report after commencement trial if there is just cause to do so, allows the court only to accept the plea agreement not guilty except for insanity unless the court has before it the report, requires it to commit the person to state hospital convicted of misdemeanor if the court person not only is affected by mental disease or defect, but also presents a substantial danger to others, requires that a person convicted of a Class C felony except for insanity that be evaluated by a local mental health authority. Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you have the fiscal in front of you. You'll see under analysis, under Oregon Health Authority, it has a fiscal of approximately $290,000.
So we would have to send it to Ways and Means.
Chair members of the committee, it's usually traditional with the fiscal of that amount to send it to. I see one of the.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. When we heard this bill before, we had several folks who were interested in having a pretty substantial amendment to this bill, and I've met with several of those folks, and I've agreed we have a couple of bills in judiciary, 2662 and 2663 relating to crime that are currently placeholders. And so I've told these folks that I would work with them to put their amendments into this different bill. And what I'd really like to see, because we had worked, Representative Olson remembers this, we'd worked with a large group of stakeholders through the years trying to start the process with the PSRB and the state hospital. And this is a bill that has agreement from all of those stakeholders. So what I would propose is that we pass the original bill and that we work on the amendments that the other folks were interested in putting into the original bill.
Okay, other discussion on that? Everybody okay with that? Mm-hmm.
I do have discussion because
of Nolan.
I'm hearing assertions that everyone with an interest in this bill is in agreement, and I am not sure that that is the case. Mr. Co-Chair, I'd actually like to hear from the folks from NAMI who can tell me whether they're okay with working on these other concerns separately.
Right there.
If
right
you're
there.
Willing
Laura,
to.
Right there.
Laura, come on up.
I don't need to have it on the record. If you're speaking on behalf of NAMI and this approach works for you, then I appreciate all the effort you Representative Tomei and Representative Olson and others have put into it.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have that on the record then. Thanks.
Thank you.
Right. Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3100 to Ways and Means.
With a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation. With a due pass.
Okay, Representative Barker has moved House Bill 3100 with a due pass to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm still working through some issues in my own head about the constitutionality of some of the provisions, and I've received some information from folks that I want to read through, but I'm just not quite there yet on the personally on the licensure and the process that they're talking about actually in court. So I'm a no vote today. That might change as I get the additional information and have a chance to digest it, and I just want that on the record. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have anything on it? Want to call the roll?
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Representative Wong?
No.
Representative Wisman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
He's excused.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request that our friend, when he gets this constitutionality question answered, that we share it with the rest of us.
No problem.
Thank you.
He'll do that for you down at Magoo's.
I hope it's not shared with us on the House floor the day we're hearing the bill. That's really what I'm trying to do.
Okay, we'll close.
He can share it with me anywhere he wants to.
We'll close the work session on 3100. Are we ready for 2707? Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2707.
Chair, members of the committee, you have before you House Bill 2707 requires a youth who is 15 to 16 in charge of measure 11 offense or waived in adult court to be detained in a juvenile detention facility unless the director of the county juvenile department and sheriff agree to detain the juvenile in the jail or other place where adults are detained. Chair, members of the committee, I think it would be helpful in this to hear from the Juvenile Directors Association, Tim Lowen and Shannon Wright, who's the sponsor of the bill, because I think some issues as it relates to the amendment in the bill need to be flushed out. We have on this bill a minimal fiscal impact, but this is another one of those bills that, even though it may be minimal to the state, could have a respectable impact to, at the county level.
Okay. Can you come on up, please?
Mr. Chair, I have committee at 3 o'clock as well, so are we going to be done by then? We're going to vote.
You better be.
Thank you.
Go ahead and take over. Which one needs to be first?
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, thank you for this opportunity to talk with you again about how, and committee members, the opportunity to talk to you about House Bill 2707 again. I'm Christina McMahon. I'm the director of the Douglas County Juvenile Department, and with me is Tim Lowen, who's the director of Yamhill County Juvenile Department. We testified before you last month and shared that philosophically, most or many of the juvenile directors in the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association agree with this bill philosophically. However, we also shared with you some concerns that many of our members have, and I'm one of those members, about the unintended financial impact that this bill could impose on many of the juvenile departments. As I stated last month, there are only four, at this time, there are 14 juvenile detention centers in the state out of 36 counties. So the majority of counties don't have their own detention center and have access to that resource immediately. I believe by July 1st, there will be even less detention centers in the state. Many of us are facing some, I can speak for my part of the state in the southern region, many juvenile departments are facing pretty significant cutbacks, and I believe that you will see a significant reduction in the amount of detention beds that are even available for juvenile departments to access. So we're concerned about the financial impact, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Lowen to comment further on that.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Yamhill County. One of the issues of fiscal impact to juvenile departments are, under the governor's balanced budget, are the loss of 34% of funding to counties to support juvenile department and diversion from of youth from youth correctional facilities. As you know already, in the governor's balanced budget, those beds are cut approximately 47%. And to understand that, the few beds that are remaining for counties, there are only about 100 beds or less remaining for counties, whereas we, when we're fully funded at 900, we have approximately 450 beds. So some of that resource at the top end has been diminished. The allocation at the in the midway portion for our supportive systems to the tune of $9.2 million has been reduced out of the governor's balanced budget. Many of those funds juvenile departments use to fund their detention facilities, and counties that don't have detention facilities use it to contract for those services in other counties. As Christina mentioned, we have lost one detention facility, Umatilla County, last biennium, to just loss of funding and support. What we're hearing right now is that we have potentially two more, at least, that may be going soon. So we have some strong concerns. Again, philosophically, this may be a very good idea. Practically, on the ground floor, it could have a huge impact in how kids come in and how long they're housed in those facilities. For instance, when in our county, when we have a Measure 11 kid, they are housed in our detention facility. However, they oftentimes stay 6 to 8, sometimes 12 months. And if that is in a small county and that's their only potential bed for juvenile matters, that could get eaten up, essentially, by the Measure 11 youth. And so it does present some concerns for many counties around the state.
Um,
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Shannon White with Partnership for Safety and Justice. Just quickly, I think if I explained to you all individually, this bill was carefully constructed to not mandate any county to have to enact this practice. It leaves it to the discretion of the juvenile department director and the sheriff. I hope we can get your vote in favor of this policy preference while still leaving absolute discretion to the people who have to work out those financial decisions within their each county.
Mr. Chair, you know, it's late. But you know what? It's frustrating when there's nothing. This is voluntary. There's nothing mandating. There is no mandated cost. So then to come and testify before me about the fear of this eating up resources that I know are shrinking, and that's bad. It really frustrates me. This is voluntary. There is no threat to resources here. You don't have to do it. The people you represent do not have to do this. So there is no threat to the shrinking resources. I'm just venting my frustration with some of the testimony from these very good people here. Thank you.
Committee members?
Okay.
Ready?
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
Juan.
You know, I'm reading section on line 27, and it says a person charged with a crime under this section who is 16 or 17 years of age shall be detained in custody in a detention facility unless a director of the county and the sheriff agree to detain them in an adult facility. So I'm reading the language, and I'm questioning whether it actually is discretionary because it says shall be detained in a detention facility, and a detention facility is defined as a juvenile location. So am I misreading it? Because that does happen.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
You are not misreading the statement of policy and preference, but what is voluntary, the decision between the two options is totally at the discretion of the officials in the county. If the county has a concern about resources, then the county, within its own boundaries, within its own leadership, can make the decision that makes the most sense either policy-wise or fiscally for that county. But that there's a preference from a policy point of view that minors who are detained prior to conviction, this is pretrial, should not be thrown in, frankly, with the wolves.
And Mr. Kosher, if I may, and I agree with what you're saying on a policy perspective. I just am wanting to clarify and make sure I understand that the director of the county juvenile department and the sheriff are likely to agree under circumstances where they have budgetary problems, and whether or not one of the two of them might throw a monkey wrench in the situation. And if they do, then you've got a fight. There is no agreement, and they must go to a detention facility. And if they must go to a detention facility in a county that doesn't have one, then we got problems.
If I might.
Excuse me?
But if I might.
Yes.
Currently, there is a default. The question is, which is the default?
Right.
Do they default to an adult facility, which is current law, or do they default to juvenile facility, which may not exist in some counties? And I appreciate your putting that point in front of us. Under current law, if philosophically or fiscally, it makes more sense for that the youth to be in a youth facility, and one party disagrees at the county level, then that party wins. I personally don't think the state should get involved in adjudicating that. We should say what our preference is, and if the sheriff refuses at a particular county, I still think that the county should sort it out themselves, not have us dragged into it.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, now that I'm listening to both what our colleagues are sharing here right now, and I thought I had a little bit of a handle on what's going on here now, but I'm not sure I do.
Schaffer?
Mr. Chair, if they don't agree at the county, in my opinion, it's their problem. I get counties and cities coming here begging for local control. This provides them with the potential for local control, and that's what they want, and that's what this bill gives them. I philosophically do not believe these kids should be thrown in with a bunch of adults if there's an option. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. But this does not deny local government, counties, ability to control their resources and make their decisions. If they can't make them among themselves, I don't know what to tell you. There's always an election. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2707 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2707 to the floor with the due pass. Any more discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm at a point right now, having read a little bit of this, and I do have a little bit of concern with the issue with the director and the sheriff having to agree on this. I'm going to be a no at this point right now, but I want to do a little bit more homework for change my vote on the House.
Any other? This has come up, just now, and I think I'm like some other people. I'm a little bit concerned. I think we're all right, and I'm going to go ahead and support the bill, but I think... Jeff, I think you and I need to talk, and if we got a problem, we're going to have to get together with Senator Provansky and staff and see if it really needs to be fixed. Okay. Can you call a roll?
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Kamei?
Aye.
Representative Wong?
Aye.
Representative Woodman?
Aye.
Co Vice Chair Garrett?
Excused.
Co Vice Chair Hicks?
Excused.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Co-Chair Peter?
Aye. House Bill 2707 goes to the floor with the due pass. Who would like to carry it?
I'll carry it,
Jeff?
Sure.
Okay. Okay, well. Close the work session on the bill, and the committee is finished for today.